You're listening to KHDX 93.1 FM, Conway, Arkansas. This is the Ouroboros Diner, and I'm your DJ and dinner companion, Drew. We are finishing up a story that we started last week today, and that is Troubled Waters by Bertrand W. Sinclair. This is... I enjoy the imagery of the story. Some of its concepts... I don't know. I have mixed ideas on the whole thing, but I think it's well written. So, last time we met Joe Galloway, who was happily married, and our main character knew him from school. I believe our main character's name is Steve. I don't quite remember. We don't hear his name a lot. And then we get... Right, he was happily married, and then we discover that he has become Joe Hall and is now a logger. Things seem to have gone wrong for Joe at some point, but they're working together at our main character's logging. I don't know the technical terms. They're working together. Joe's working for Steve, and nearby there is this... terrible area of water that kills people regularly, and they rescue a guy from that water, and now he works for them with them also, Broderick. And finally, we've gotten Joe's backstory. It turns out that his wife and he were happily married for ages until one day she said, "I'm sorry, but I've met another man that I'm in love with. I can't do this anymore." And he argued with her for a while, but then he accepted it. He gave her half of his money and left, and wasted all his money on drinking until he finally had to start making money again and found himself here. And Broderick was like, "What? You never contacted her again? What if she changed her mind? You know women?" That's my main problem with this story. But here we are. "No chance," Broderick echoed, with a tinge of scorn in his voice. "The law of probabilities is all on your side. I wish I felt my chances as good. I wish that my chance of happiness had been half as good as yours. Would I throw up my hand to go wandering up and down the earth with pain and uncertainty and self-pity like thorns in my flesh? I should say not." "You don't understand," Joe answered somberly. "There's some things a man can't put into words. He can only feel them." "But I do understand," Broderick insisted. "I've been through the mill. A man gets on the grid, and he can only squirm. I know what it is to ache with a pain that isn't physical. But with me it came of actual, unescapable knowledge. The pain of sheer, unchangeable hopelessness. You took a lot of things for granted. Seems to me you ran away under fire." Joe threw out his hands impotently. "What the devil else could I do?" he demanded harshly. "She had to be free, free to marry the man she wanted. I could have stood on my rights as a husband. What was the use? She'd only have hated me. It wasn't any light love affair with her. She wasn't that kind. She wanted happiness. She could only see it in a certain direction. But she wanted it to come decently and honorably. There was no ground for divorce. I had to devise a ground, so I deserted her. As I saw it, there wasn't anything else for me to do." Broderick's eyes gleamed. "You're a man," he said quietly. "A real man. But a fool for all that, I think. Didn't it ever occur to you that she might really miss you after those years of intimate living? That your clean sweep of everything might have made a gap in her life that nothing but you yourself could fill in again? A woman's human, gifted or cursed, as you like to put it, with all the human vagaries of impulse. Sometimes it takes a grand upheaval to make us see things as they really are, to know ourselves." Joe got to his feet and threw his arms wide to the sunset and let them fall by his side. "Why should I try to fool myself?" he said. "All I want is to forget. That's all." He went into the cabin. We heard the creak of his bunk as he threw himself down. Broderick clasped both hands over his knees and stared at the ground. his brows knitted, as over some problem he strove to solve. After a minute, he looked at me. "Joe unburdened his soul very completely," he said. "Does his right name happen to be Galloway?" "Why, yes, that's his name," said I, surprised into admission. "How did you know?" "I didn't know," Broderick muttered. "But I had a hunch." He sat for a little while, picking up pebbles and casting them over the bank with a flip of his hand. Then he, too, rose and went into the cabin. The door stood open beside me, and the small window above my head. Every word they uttered within came distinctly to me. I heard Broderick repeat almost word for word, impatiently, challengingly, the last questioning sentences he had put to Joe. "Why bother me with your theories?" Galloway answered roughly. "What is it to you? What do you know about these things I've been fool enough to talk about?" "I know all there is to know about it," Broderick answered slowly. "A great deal more than you yourself know. I'm the other man." I drew beyond hearing at that. It lay between the two of them, a matter intimate and grievous, not for casual ears. So I moved to the corner, where only came the indistinguishable drone of their voices, wondering to myself if the devil that rises in men where a woman is concerned would presently set them at each other's throats. They were strong, passionate men. I was a little afraid for them, for I liked them both. An hour passed. Dusk merged into darkness. Still they talked, their voices never rising above that repressed murmur. Then the lamp flashed its yellow square through the doorway, and both came out. Joe turned away and walked along the cliff slowly, a dim outline in the night. Broderick stood looking about. Presently he called, "Oh, Steve!" "Here," I answered. He came and sat down on the ground beside me. The match he laid to his pipe bowl showed his face hard drawn. His eyes smoldered. "Did you hear?" he asked. "I heard you declare yourself," said I frankly. "Then I moved out of earshot." He sat silent for a time. "Joe doesn't actively blame me," he said at last, "but he resents everything. He's lived within himself so long, bottling up his grief, that he's morbid. I can't do anything with him, can't make him see sense. The thing he ought to do for their own two sakes, write to Norma or go to her and make up, he won't do. You knew her, it seems. You heard his side of it, absolutely true, so far as it goes. But there's two sides to everything." "Fire away," said I, for I knew by his tone that he was smoldering inside, that he wanted the relief of talk that would neither be misunderstood nor resented. "Joe made the same mistake that other men have made and regretted," Broderick went on, "as near as I can gather. He let his ambition and his business overshadow his wife and his home. I suppose he felt that everything was fixed and secure and final. And that's a bad thing with any woman young and proud and passionate as Norma Galloway. It was very simple. Joe was getting wholly immersed in his business. He was traveling a lot for his firm, and I happened to wander into her life at a time when she was in a particularly receptive state of mind. That sounds commonplace, but I'm not good at analysis. I loved her in my own headlong way. Nothing else mattered to me but her. I knew where I stood. She thought she did. There wasn't anything sordid or underhand about it. We talked it over from every angle, God knows. She wasn't happy with him. All her feeling for him seemed dead. She knew I loved her, and she believed she loved me, and that for us, too, life together meant happiness if we could take it up honorably together. So she told him. And you know how he played his part. I've known Joe since we were kids, I said. He's a white man. He is, Broderick agreed. Every inch of him. But, as I said, something of a fool where a woman's heart is concerned. He took too much for granted, let go too easily. He didn't have anything but her word for it, and a woman's word is nothing in matters of this sort. One can talk and talk and never get anywhere. It's deeds that count. He didn't give her a chance. He never saw me, never even knew my name. I wasn't looming a big figure before him to drive him insane with impotent jealousy. But when the big upheaval came, he effaced himself as absolutely as if he had been buried. He made no effort to learn how things went. And then, Broderick bowed his head for a second. Then, after he was gone, and there was nothing to do but wait patiently a little while, get a divorce quietly, and marry me, she woke up. It wasn't me she wanted, it was Joe. She had loved him in the beginning. When he'd made the complete renunciation, stepped out of her life for good and all, she found something lacking, a place that nobody else could fill, that she wanted him back, that her heart ached to have him back. Oh, you can't ever tell anything about a woman. And yet, I suppose it was only natural. He had become a part of her life. I was only an incident. I suppose so many things used to rise up and make her long for him. She had lived with him. The nearest she'd ever been to me was to kiss me shyly once or twice. Anyway, once he was gone, it was all different. The money he gave her, she banked and left alone. She would no more have lived on it than she would have let me support her. She used to say that she was being punished for breaking a good man's heart for a passing whim. Broderick lifted his head and laughed harshly. "Meaning Joe, of course," he said. It didn't seem to occur to her that I was very deeply involved. The most she would let me do for her was to help her get a position. I happened to have a cousin in the millinery business in Utica, and Norma got work there, enough to live decently on. And when I had tried every means to move her, and failed, I had to get out and get action or go crazy. So I went on the tramp, like Joe, a good deal. I can live anywhere, under any conditions. And there you are. But, he broke out after a little, I didn't let go like he did. I wrote to her, time and again at first, every few months since. That's how I know where she is, and how she still feels. She's there yet, pegging away, waiting. She's his wife, legally, in spirit, every way. She's been true as steel, and her one solace is that sometime he'll come back, or she'll find out where he is and win him back and make up somehow for these ghastly years. And can you see the tragedy in it? Broderick went on. He refuses to act. He won't do anything. He says he has suffered till he's numb. And I can't make him see that she has suffered too, is suffering yet, as he is. It's pride. If I were in his place, I'd have no pride. I'd crawl on my hands and knees in the dust back to her if I could create for myself the longing she has for him. It isn't worthwhile to be proud and aloof and miserable when all you have to do is reach out your hands for happiness. Two of us can get our feet out of this deadly coil. Why should all three be lonely and miserable? I know he doesn't want to have it that way. It's just a stubborn streak. He's morbid. What has been can't be helped. But the future, that's a different matter. You might write and tell her where he is and how he feels about it, I suggested. That would be a fine thing to do. Broderick laughed hard and mirthlessly. I suppose I could, he said, but it would be better if he made the first move. However, I know she wouldn't hesitate. Yes, I dare say it would be eminently proper for me to be the god in the machine, to bring them together with a heaven bless you, my children, and then fade away. Well, I don't know. I'll have to think about that. He got up abruptly and walked into the cabin. When I followed, he was in his bunk, the blankets drawn over his head. A few minutes later, Joe came in. What sort of truce they had declared, I never knew. Between them as men, there was genuine liking. If that matter of a woman had stirred up feeling of any intensity between them, they were men enough to repress it. So, for a matter of 2 weeks, the days marched past, filled with a monotonous labor of cutting and piling cedar bolts. The fall days were on us with their long gray evenings. My Bolt contract was about done, and we took it easy, working short hours. The first man enkindled the kitchen fire, and also built another on the ground before the cabin door. When we had eaten, we would sit outside under the projecting eave, smoking our pipes before the cheerful crackling logs. It was pretty much as it had been before that night of soul unburdenings, except that we talked a bit less freely. There was more of constraint upon us. Then, one evening, in the first gray of dusk, when we had knocked off early and were sitting outside by the fire, watching the same tubby coaster that had brought Galloway to Codare go lurching past Skeleton Point into the maw of Hellgate, I heard the clatter of a buggy on the little used road that ran between the landing and my camp. In a minute, it gained the clearing. I saw the figure of a woman beside the driver. A few seconds later, she was clambering out and walking toward us with a firm step. Norma Galloway, just as I recalled her. Fair strands of hair wind-blown across her face, deep blue eyes shining, lips a trifle parted, her gaze fixed on Joe. I turned to look for Broderick. He was all but behind the cabin, and he beckoned me imperatively. I followed. It didn't matter, anyway. There was only one man looming before her, and he stood rooted to the ground as if he doubted the evidence of his visual sense. Broderick stood along the cliff. When I caught up with him, he was seated on a log, holding his face in his hands. "You did right. And she came," I said, for lack of something less obvious. "Shut up," he gritted. "I'm not in a talking mood." I don't know how long we sat there. Broderick did not move, nor lift his head. It grew dark. I looked toward the cabin now and then, and once saw the fire break into a yellow gleam when someone stirred it. "I guess all's quiet along the Potomac." Broderick lifted his face at last. "I've done my bit. Let's go back." We walked slowly. Nearing the cabin and the soft glow before it, a stick broke in a shower of sparks and sent up a bright flame that threw into bold relief two figures. Joe on a block seat, his wife curled on the earth beside him, smiled up at him, and then at me. There wasn't any further explanation needed. "Ed has gone," I said, and added a white lie to smooth things. "He told me to wish you luck." It seemed to me a shade of relief crossed both their faces. Love is selfish, but I couldn't blame them. I gave them the cabin that night and made my bed by the fire. But I didn't sleep. No. Broderick loomed too big in my mind. The back Eddie had brought him unwitting to the spot, to straighten a grievous tangle in two lives, to bring peace to unquiet souls. And it might be that the Eddie took him away. I don't know. I've often wondered. I know I never saw him again. Never heard of him again. And that's the end of Troubled Waters by Bertrand W. Sinclair. That was published in 1915. It's a pretty good story. As I said, I really like the imagery of it, especially that last fire scene, but in particular earlier in the story, I'm sorry you missed it if you did, the Hell Gate, he describes that for a good long time, and it is gorgeous to read. So, since we have quite a bit of time post the finishing of that story, I figured I'd finally play that song that was requested last week. Sorry for putting it off. And indeed, I've made a little mini playlist to go along with it, with a good bit of help from my dad. Thank you, Dad. I'm going to keep talking for a little bit under a minute so that I don't have to worry about certain things. But, yeah. Yeah, as I said, the annoying thing about that story is it kind of goes back and forth between the theme that, like, women are human and humans are impulsive, and Broderick saying things like, you can't trust a woman. A woman's spirit is so changeable. Women don't know what they're talking about. Like, okay. Okay, Broderick. Anyway, you're listening to KHDX 93.1 FM, Conway, Arkansas. This is the Ouroboros Diner. I'm your DJ and dinner companion, Drew, and we are now doing a playlist of songs named after goddesses, and we're starting with Isis by Bob Dylan.
I could not hold on to her very long, so I cut off my hair and I rode straight away for the wild unknown country where I could not go wrong. I came to a high place of darkness and light. The biting light ran through the center of town. I hitched up my pony to a post on the right. Went into a laundry, I washed my clothes down. A man in the corner approached me for a match. I knew right away he was not ordinary. He said, are you looking for something easy to catch? Said, I got no money. He said, that ain't necessary. We set out that night for the cold in the north. I gave him my blanket and he gave me his word. I said, where are we going? He said, we'll be back by the fourth. I said, that's the best news that I've ever heard. I was thinking about turquoise, I was thinking about gold, I was thinking about diamonds and the world's biggest necklace as we rode through the canyons, through the devilish cold. I was thinking about Isis, how she thought I was so reckless. How she told me that one day we would meet up again and things would be different the next time we were. If I only could hang on and just be her friend. I still can't remember all the best things she said. We came to the pyramids all embedded in ice. He said, there's a body I'm trying to find. If I carry it out, it'll bring a good price. 'Twas then that I knew what he had on his mind. The wind, it was a howling, and the snow was outrageous. We chopped through the night, and we chopped through the dawn. When he died, I was hoping that it wasn't contagious. But I made up my mind that I had to go on. I broke into the tomb, but the casket was empty. There was no jewels, no nothing. I felt I've been had. When I saw that my partner was just being friendly, when I took up his offer, I must have been mad. I cracked the cover. I said a quick prayer, and I felt satisfied. Then I rode back to find Isis, just to tell her I love her. She was there, in the meadow, where the creek used to rise. Blindly by sleep, and in need of a bed. I came in from the east, with the sun in my eyes. There one time, then I rode on ahead. She said, where you been? I said, no place special. She said, you look different. I said, well, I guess. She said, you've been gone. I said, that's only natural. She said, you're gonna stay. I said, if you want me to, yes.
That was Isis by Bob Dylan. Next up is Ipana by Eluveita, and Eluveiti, rather. They're a Swedish band. Ipana is a Celtic horse goddess, I believe one of three. This band, they're sort of in the genre of death metal. This one's not so much in that direction. Which I don't listen to a lot, but it does intrigue me because a lot of their songs they sing in a reconstructed form of Gaulish, which is an ancient Celtic language from around the period of the Roman Empire. So, yeah, and this one is one of those, so hope you enjoy. That was Epana by Aluveti. Next up is Athena by The Who. That was Athena by The Who. Next up is Our Lady of the Largest Heart, We Exalt You by Anoon Enthusiast. And that is an epitaph that refers to Inanna, the Sumerian goddess of love and war. So I figured before I played that one, I would read a bit of that, of the hymn that epitaph, epitaph. Different things. Similar words, different things. But that comes from. And this is a hymn written by Enheduanna, who wrote most, I think, of the hymns that we have for Inanna, despite being a priestess of Nanna. Anyway, this is a translation written by Annette Zgal. It doesn't actually have the epithet as we tend to refer to it Lady of the Largest Heart. Here it's written Lady of All the Divine Powers, Resplendent Light. But it just depends on the translation. This one's more accurate. Okay. Lady of all the divine powers, resplendent light, righteous woman clothed in radiance, beloved of An and Uruk, mistress of heaven with the great pectoral jewels, who loves the good headdress befitting the office of En priestess, who has seized all seven of its divine powers. My lady, you are the guardian of the great divine powers. You have taken up the divine powers. You have hung the divine powers from your hand. You have gathered up the divine powers, you have clasped the divine powers to your breast. Like a dragon, you have deposited venom on the foreign lands. When like ichor you roar at the earth, no vegetation can stand up to you. As a flood descending upon those foreign lands, powerful one of heaven and earth, you are there, Inanna. It's quite the long hymn. But if you're interested, it's called The Exaltation of Inanna, and I do recommend it, and all of Enheduanna's poetry. There's some debate whether she is one person or multiple, because as you might be able to guess from her name, it is the name of a person who is in a station. I guess just the name given to the priestess of Nanna. So it's kind of, it's debatable. These might just be separate poems written by different priestesses. I don't know how common it was for a priestess of one god to write hymns and poetry about another, but I don't see why that would be uncommon. There's a lot of similarity between the poems, but that might just be the fashion of the times. You know, it's all this different stuff to take into account, and of course, I am certainly no expert, just reading whatever I find on the internet. But anyway, yes, yeah, so this song is Our Lady of the Largest Heart, We Exalt You, by a Noon Enthusiast. And right before I play it, I will remind you that you are listening to KHDX 93.1 FM, Conway, Arkansas. This is the Ouroboros Diner. And we are concluding our broadcast for the day in just a little bit. But first, this.
Thank you.
That was Our Lady of the Largest Heart, We Exalt You by a Noon Enthusiast. So, long-time listeners may be thinking and panicking a little bit. Drew, it's almost the end of the show and we haven't had a compare and contrast. Well, don't you worry about that. Next up, and finally for the Goddess playlist, is Venus in Furs by the Velvet Underground. Venus, of course, being another name for Aphrodite. But also, of course, this song is based on the book Venus in Furs by Leopold von Sacher-Masoch, which is known for certain things. So I'm also going to be playing another song based on that book. I actually already posted a comparison of these two songs on the KHDX website for Valentine's Day. So if you want to check that out, please do. But first off, Venus in Furs by the Velvet Underground.
Sleep different colors made of tears. Of leather, whiplash girl child in the dark. Severin, your servant, comes in bells, please don't forsake him. Strike, dear mistress, and cure his heart.
That was Venus and Furs by The Velvet Underground. And finally, to finish off our show for the day, The Ballad of Leopold von Sacher-Masoch by Kid Scientist. I hope you'll join me again next week.
Be the last to know if you'll be coming home tonight. I mouth the benediction and sleep my pieces on the board. This normal life is such a punishment, so aberration's my reward. You couldn't even begin to conceive of the pains you've put me through. That's why I've arranged to hang you from chains and at length impart to you the nature of my disease. If God was such an artist, then in his image I came. And how your body will be worshipped when you're screaming our name. Now I think it's beginning to sink in, severity of my appeal. As you surface for air and unclasp your long black hair, I collapse beneath your heels and relish the pain of my disease. We'll be right back. consent to the abuse. Now seduce me with those eyes and dig your nails into this prison of skin, till by grace I see the light.